Welcome to the All for Inclusion podcast. This is the place where the conversation starts. You will hear plenty of stories on how disability has impacted people from school through to work. The struggles they have faced and how they've overcome them. There will be lots of tips on how businesses, society, and people can become more inclusive. Here's your host, Scott Whitney.
Welcome to our next episode of the All for Inclusion pod. Joining me today is Jamie Shields. Now, Jamie refers to himself as a rhinoceros. Jamie, do you want to please expand on why you are a rhinoceros?
Yeah, so I am a registered blind rhino. I'm visually impaired. I'm also gay. And when I was younger, I can remember people used to call me names for being gay. So I say, just it's kind of sarcastic remark was, yes, I parked my unicorn outside. And I got this notebook years ago that said, rhinos are just chubby unicorns. And I was like, this is perfect. This sounds like me. And then I realized that rhinos actually have bad eyesight. So they have some of the worst eyesight in the animal kingdom. So I was like, this is definitely me. Chubby, blind, and just sprinkles everywhere. So yeah, that's why I am the registered blind rhino.
So rhinos have very low eyesight. So there are some animals out there that have zero eyesight. Rhinos, on my Google search, which is as accurate as Google can be, is saying it is the worst vision of an animal that has vision. So what other four animals do you think join it in the top five?
Oh God, I'm going to say elephants. I think elephants is one too.
Oh, it's not there.
Really? Not, oh there. God. But bats don't have that. Does bat kind of, they don't have bad eyesight though, do they?
Oh, that is classed in there. Yeah. It says bats aren't blind. However, this doesn't mean that they can spot a tasty bug across a cave with no trouble.
Oh, so bats one. A badger has bad eyesight. I know that from watching like a kids program years ago.
Animals are farthing wood.
Yeah, actually, was it?
It's not in there, but yeah, I would probably say it is.
Oh, God, then I don't know. I'm trying to think. I'm thinking mammals, and I don't know why. I'm like, maybe there's lizards out there with bad snakes. The snakes have good eyesight. They're bound to have bad eyesight.
Oh, yeah, I think they have. I'll give you the others. I'll have a podcast just on Jamie guessing animals with poor eyesight. So moles have bad eyesight, and some types of mole have no eyesight at all. They've just gone quite vague with one, which is deep sea fish.
That but it's so dark down there, I don't think anybody can see.
Yeah, exactly. And then the other one shocked me. It was the bull.
Do you know what? I could believe that. Do you know, I watched a bit. I didn't watch it. A friend showed me this video earlier. It was, do you know those balls you put yourself in and roll down hills, or you run at each other kind of thing? They're like big inflatable, I don't know what you call them, like big inflatable balls. And there were people just like standing, playing football with this big ball in them, but a bull's chasing them and hitting them and stuff. So yeah. Bulls, when they're doing those flag things, like they're horrible to do, but those bulls don't know where they're running. They run towards the red instead of the person. So I can believe that.
Yeah, exactly. But I definitely didn't think that. I thought they was quite good being able to target in on someone, but obviously not.
I'm surprised badgers aren't the top of this list. I'm like, every show I can think of, badgers have worn at glasses. I'm like, they have bad eyesight, don't they?
Yeah. So do you want to tell people a little bit more about yourself, what you're doing when it comes to inclusion at the moment?
I am registered blind, as I said. So the medical term for my disability is ocular albinism with nystagmus, which essentially means I am the same as an albino with pigmentation, and the nystagmus means my eyes go for little walks, little dances, and it's uncontrolled. So I was registered blind when I was quite wee. I have a condition where it's hereditary. It's passed from females, passed it on to males. And it's meant to skip a generation, but it didn't do it with my family. I don't know what happened there. I think I broke the curse. But with it means like I struggled pretty much a lot in my life, from education through to employment. Both struggled to gain employment and retain it. So I ended up jumping job to job, really. Like, I was job hopping. I had more jobs than I did hot dinners at the time, and I was trying to be independent. I think that one of the things with me is I am wretched blind, but I still have sight, so I do. So I try to be as independent as possible. And I think with my mum, like everybody's mum, they're usually quite overprotective over here, aren't they? So you almost dropped out in cotton wool, and I didn't want that, so I moved away to the city, like 45 minutes away from my mum. Wasn't the best idea, especially when your job hopping. So the times I struggled by and just didn't tell anybody. So then I fell into this job in recruitment. I seen a friend post on Facebook, it was a thicko, we're looking for people for my work. And I had just left quite a big employer and had just been discriminated against, treated really poorly, and was kind of at the stage just giving up on employment and just take the advice from a doctor and just go on benefits. But I said, nope, I'm not doing that. And went for this job, what I thought was a call centre, ended up being recruitment, ended up being the best job of my life. I've been in it 3 years. I've worked with clients doing recruitment. So the company I work for is Alexander Mann Solutions. We are AMS, we rebranded, and we essentially support recruitment of clients globally. And in my job, I was supporting clients doing their own recruitment. Then I worked internally, but at the side of my desk, I was our global disability employee resource group lead, which is a fancy way of just saying I kind of help lead a group community within AMS with both lived experience and advocates. To talk about disability, to put it kind of within our business culture to drive inclusion. And then that role then transpired there a few months ago into me becoming our disability inclusion coordinator. But now my role is helping drive disability across the globe. So that is my day job. I also did a podcast called That Thing Called Inclusion, which was all about inclusion, giving tips to businesses and job seekers. That's now ceased. So I'm now actually doing a new podcast called Inclusivity -T, not actually spelled inclusivity. And it's pretty much the same principle, tips for job seekers, businesses, and just sharing lived experience and amplifying voices, but like what you try to do, because I think that lived experience is so important. And that's what I do in my day job as well, is amplify voices. I thought it was a really long answer, wasn't it?
It was, but do you know what? I love long answers. What was it like going through school then for you, Jamie?
When I was in primary school, I went to mainstream school. So I struggled really badly in school. So everybody knew I was struggling, but there was a spike going on in the background with the education board. And my mum wanted me to go into specialist education, which I hate that term, special education, because to me, when I was younger, even in mainstream school, I was put in special class or special needs class, and I do that in inverted commas. It was a class for children who they deemed couldn't be in a classroom. So if you were disabled, if you were neurodivergent, if there was anything that made your needs different to anybody in that class, you were in special needs. So I was placed in special needs. Now, I'm quite a sociable person. In special needs class, you were treated very much. You went to class, you're almost like this individual who is in a room with other individuals, but you weren't treated as such. So you were really segregated and then segregated again. So I struggled. And I remember I think it was like P7, the teacher said to my mummy, he needs to man up. And my mummy's like, what do you mean? He's like, well, he can't play sport. Like, I'm registered blind. Of course, I can't play sport. Like, I know like, there's people out there who play it, but when you're playing in a non-accessible way with classmates who don't understand disability, because you don't teach disability at school, we don't teach how to be inclusive. It was like my mum ended up, I think, I'm not going to say she hit him, but she did something to the teacher. And honestly, it was like back and forth because she had to keep fighting to get me into specialist education. Then she got me into specialist education, which was great, but it was me traveling an hour each way to school and then an hour home in the afternoon. And I could have boarded, but I didn't want to because I didn't want to miss out. My family, I'm a big family, I had friends. And to me, I didn't want to be special anymore. I'd be special in primary school and I didn't want that to be my teenage years, if you will. But it ended up being my teenage years because I used to tell my friends that I went to a boarding school, but I didn't board. I didn't tell them that I'm too blind. I told everybody I needed glasses. So I stayed in specialist school and I stayed there 6 years to do my GCSEs because in that school we actually got an additional year to do it. So we actually had like entry level exams in fifth year and then sixth year we did a GCSE. So it really was fantastic. The teachers were specially trained. But again, I felt special. I didn't understand why I still had to be segregated from people. Why did I have to travel so far to go to school and my friends could just hop into the bus and go across the next town or just walk to school? Why was I having to travel and be different? I decided after doing my GCSEs, I didn't want to go to special school no more. Went to England and did university over there college over there with people who were visually impaired as well. My uncle did it, he has the same condition, but I didn't want to do it again. I was just like, why do I have to go away to get an education? So I went to mainstream school. Worst mistake of my life when you're 16, 17, leaving education after been supported for so long. Like, I bullied really badly. I was mocked for having a disability. I was mocked also for being gay. So, like, I learned to pretty much mask a lot of my identity for a few years. Like, I didn't want to be gay, didn't want to be disabled, didn't want to ask for help. My teachers didn't really understand. I was doing art, and you think art, oh, easy subject, all you do is draw. Completely wrong. I thought that too. It's a lot harder than it was. I was having to sew, and I was getting shouted at and told off because I couldn't sew in the pattern, or I couldn't thread the needle. And I can remember the teacher used to tut, like, when I asked her to help me thread the needle. And honestly, I don't know. I love making things. Like, I make Halloween costumes every year, but they're absolutely a mess if you look at the stitching. But I just like the creativity. So to me, it absolutely shot my confidence. I struggled, as I said, and I hated school, so I did. And then I told the teachers I was getting bullied. Nothing was done about it at all, because nothing's ever done about bullying. It's always the victim's fault. So I stayed in school. I managed to get my A-levels in art. It was a double award, but I ended up having to drop out of ICT because they weren't making adjustments. They didn't understand. And honestly, for 2 years, it was 2 years of my life. I hated secondary, not even secondary school. It was like college. It was A-levels, but I'd went to a mainstream school. Yeah, my education was... It had a slight high peak when I went to specialist school, which is Jorgenstown in Northern Ireland. Like, it was a brilliant school. The teachers there were incredible. Like, to this day, my art teacher is still one of my biggest motivators when I draw, when I do anything creative, because she used to say, just because you can't see anything doesn't mean that it doesn't look good. It's how you are perceiving it to the world. Like, the world will perceive it differently to how you perceive it, and that's the beauty of kind of your art. And I used to laugh at it, and to this day, I still can't thank her for saying it. And I'm like, it's so true. Everything I do is my own unique way. Like, I make posters online on LinkedIn, and sometimes not even, sometimes I'll probably mess it up, and sometimes I'll probably have a typo here and there, but to me, I'm like, it's all part of the process. Like, it's me at face value. I'll make typos and I'll see things, but that's from my teacher. She taught me that. But yeah, off on a tangent there, but yeah, education was not the best.
So yeah, it was varied and challenging. But if you was now to go back knowing what you know now, how would your education be? What would you choose it to be?
I wouldn't have went to specialist education. I would have probably, I think it's a child or a young person, you're so overlooked. Until you get over your teens, you don't have any kind of say in your own life. And I think that when you have a child who's going through diagnosis for any kind of thing to do with disability or neurodiversity, any kind of diagnosis, you're in a room as adults talk and make the decisions with your life. Like, I'm 32 now, and I still remember the conversation my mum had with the my social worker and the school board and the education authority to try to get me into that special school. And my mum fought tooth and nail to get me in because she knew I'd fall through the gaps in mainstream education. But if I had the confidence, or if I had the knowledge now, or if the laws and the way things are done were different, and back in 94 or 5, if things may have been different, but if I could go back now or meet somebody my age now, I'd tell them to stay in school, and you have rights. You need to know your parents should not make all the decisions. You have a say, because that was taken away from me. And when I left specialist education, I wasn't socially, like, not that I was socially, didn't know how to behave socially, but I just didn't know how to interact with people who weren't disabled. I didn't know how to really make friends. And I wasn't bullied in school, don't get me wrong, but obviously being gay, I was quite noticeably gay when I was younger. To everybody else, it was not to myself, because I didn't realise until I was like 17, so I got bullied for that too. So I think for me, if I could go back and say to myself, it would be learn to speak up for yourself, speak back, don't take the nonsense or let the adults overtalk you, because that's always happened. Everyone always said this is what you need, rather than saying, what do you need?
In schools, it's a very tricky place for anyone, and there's a lot of people that it is so easy just to get into that culture where, look, we want to be in the cool gang, and if you're not in the cool gang, then part of my way of staying in is by sometimes intentionally and being harmful in speaking out, and sometimes unintentionally. But either way, it can cause a lot of stress, a lot of anxiety, and a lot of depression for other people. What was your mental health like going through school? I know you having these sort of hour journeys going in, coming out.
Like, in school, I think when I was in specialist education, I was okay. But once I got to, because I hated going to, don't get me wrong, I hated having to travel, I hated being different and stuff. But When I was in special education, I was happy because I still had friends at school and friends who understood my eyesight. I didn't have to hide to them. It was just when I came home, I put on my new mask. And like, I remember I came home and it'd be dead 3:30 and put on Pokemon. Well, sorry, it was 4:30. Sorry, I'm not from my take. It was 4:30. I came home and put on Pokemon. And it was my little thing I used to do. And then my friends would call over and I would go out and play with them. When I kind of went to mainstream school, things just went, I don't know if it went back to front. Like, I think like bullying really impacts everybody, but until I kind of went to my A levels, I started drinking. Like, I binge drank, so I did. I lashed out at my parents. I lashed out at the world. I probably broke a lot of relationships with friends and probably impacted relationships with family members, especially my dad. Obviously, he was very protective of me, and I used to fight with him all the time for it. And I same with my mum. But I think for me, I was masking so much. Like, the masking was, it was hard to try to mask that you're gay. It's hard to try to mask that you're registered blind when it's quite visible when you're on your phone and when you have people going, oh, look how closely you look to your phone, where's your glasses, or just these wee cheeky one-liners. And it's just kids being kids, but those kind of things really impact you. When I was doing my A-levels, I was up and down. My mental health suffered from like 18 to probably 26, 27. I really stuck, actually 28 probably is when I started. That's 28. Like, my mental health really suffered. It went up and down for years. I think a lot of that there is, as I said, like holding it in. Like, I continued to mask even when I finished school. I was masking in jobs. I was telling employers that I was bad eyesight, the glasses couldn't help, or I told them that I was visually impaired. I never told them I'm registered blind. I'm registered blind. I can't actually see the training. I can't actually see these invites you're sending me. I can't even use your website. Like, I held all this in, and I was my own worst enemy. But it was just because I think from what happened in school, I was not like I was traumatized or PTSD or anything, but those things really do just chip away at you. So you do, and you hold on to them. And when things kind of escalate or things get bad, it all tumbles out of you. So I just rolled through employment, from education to employment, dropped out of university 3 times because I wasn't getting support there. So I was lost. And I think if anyone says, what was Jamie like then, he was lost. And I think when I was getting diagnosed with depression, anxiety, or all these other different things, they were giving me tablets and they were impacting, I think, a lot more. And I got to be quite honest, I had moments where I was suicidal and I did silly things. And thankfully, I have very observant family members and friends, and they really scooped me up and helped me get back on track. But for me, I think I didn't find my place until I found empowerment, my disability. Once I found that empowerment, my disability, I found a wee bit more empowerment, even in my sexuality. I found empowerment talking about being neurodiverse. And I do think that when I was being diagnosed with depression, a lot of the times, I just didn't know how to handle the feelings inside my head. So I think sometimes that overspilled, and that kind of affected me not getting a diagnosis of depression, rather than actually saying this could be something else, this could be something to do with neurodivergence. It was just completely ruled out. So it was just kept pumped full of tablets. So yeah, my mental health was not great. So it's not. And even to this day, I'm an advocate. So you say to somebody, how are you? And they say, okay. I'll say that person, okay, it's not a feeling. Like, tell me how you really feel. But when somebody says it to me, I say the same answers. Yep, I'm okay. Because I don't like talking about my mental health to anybody. It took me years to get to the place to even talk to my parents or talk to my partner about my mental health. Even though I have visible scars that I have covered up in a tattoo in my arm. And when I look down at that, to me now, I'm like, I should be able to talk about this. But to me, I'm like, I don't need to talk about it. Because I now have new ways to kind of unleash that. So I can't go into trainings. If I'm in training and talk about mental health, I'm like, I can't listen to this. I have to go write down my feelings, or I have to go create an angry graphic or picture or paint. I love to paint. So it's strange because I advocate so much for mental health, but I don't try to talk about mine or share mine with anyone except my partner, really, or my mum.
Sometimes it's the advice that you very freely and often give to others is the advice that you just don't take on board yourself, isn't it?
Yeah, I tell people all the time at work. Like, I'll see somebody message me at like 9 o'clock and they'll be like, get offline, what are you doing? You're crazy. It's like, well, why are you online to say I'm online? I'm like, that doesn't matter, get offline. It's easier to give than take advice. I've learned that so many times in my life.
Yeah. And one thing I've said to a lot of people is giving advice, receiving help. There's a lot of people that wrongfully think asking for help is a sign of weakness. But if you ask 100 people, would you give someone help if they need it, you're going to find 100 people more often than not that are going to say, yes, we would. And it's a sign of strength, in my opinion, to be able to inwardly recognize that you need support. And whether that's mental health, whether that's with a skill or a sales part of the job or whatever, it's that same recognition and asking is, I believe, is definitely a sign of strength. So going into work then, Jamie, yep. Like, I know you was bouncing around quite a few jobs. You said that you didn't tell people that you registered blind.
Yeah, so when I first left university the first time, so I went to university the first time to do art. So when I was doing art, I was struggling, like I couldn't do classes, and I'd taken a job in a nightclub. And I said, like, if I tell this bar that I can't see, and when I'm in a club, it's so much harder for me to see. Like when I'm in a club now or a bar, my partner has to hold my hand, and I make him do it really discreetly because I hate holding hands in public. I'm so weird about PDA, but I'm like, just guide me. But when I back then, I didn't want anyone to know. I was like, they're going to think I'm really weird. Oh, look at this blind boy trying to get a job in a club. So I got a job in the bar, and it was like a proper nightclub. It was so dark, I don't know why I did it, but like for a few months I got on with it and I met some really great people. But it became very obvious that I couldn't use the tills. It became very obvious I wasn't great at cleaning in the dark. And then they were like, what can we give him to do what isn't going to be too dodgy for him to be at? And I ended up becoming a shop boy. So I had a backpack like Ghostbusters, and I used to give shots out to people. They used to come up to me and I gave the shots for £2 or £3 if you want a tip, as I used to say. And I did that, and because I was struggling at university, I was just like, I'm dropping this and just doing this as my job. Realised working in a bar when you're registered blind, you're not going to get very far. You're not enjoying your job. And the sleep was killing me. Like, I wasn't getting enough sleep. So I left that and went into call centres and thought, this is going to be sweet. Everybody says call centres are great. Nope, they were not great. And back, this is 12 years ago, like, call centres were not what they are today. There was no support. So like I had told the first place I'd ever worked, I had bad eyesight and talking about commas. And I said, it's really bad now, I will struggle. And they were like, oh, it could be fine, kind of thing. And then I remember going through a field interview and the girl said to me, oh, we haven't got anybody with disability working for us. And it was almost like then I became this exciting thing for them, like this shiny little toy. And when I got the job, I managed to get the job. And I think this is, I'm going to be honest, in interviews, I think because I go down so many tangents, I'm like, I give you so much information, like you get the answer somewhere, but you get so much more. So there's like bonus points. So I got the job. And then in the job itself, the training I couldn't do. I couldn't see the board at all. I was copying everybody else's answers. And when I say copying, like, I couldn't see what they were typing. So I was making notes to look. And people would obviously guess, what is he doing? Like, he's so close to that computer, he can't see. And it got to the point where I'd have to tell a trainer, and I'd pull him aside and say to him, listen, I'm right to the blind. I can't see anything you're doing. I can't see these systems. I'm panicking. And it'd be like, no worries, we'll keep it between us and all. And then you go into the room and it'd be like, Jamie, can you see this? Can you see from here? Can you see this? And again, those kind of, oh my God, I'll think I'm different, kicked in. I had many instances of that there whilst I'd left the bar. So that happened two or three times. Then I got a job in another call centre. And again, I had the same thing. Oh, we've never had somebody who's blind work with us before. And I had to explain to them again, I'm not blind. I'm registered blind. I can still see. I have some sight. It's not the best sight. And you wouldn't want me to tell you what way to look when you're driving or coming out of a junction. But I can still see. And got the job. Same thing happened to training. Made a friend who let me copy all their notes. Made it past the training this time. On the systems, it was terrible. Like, my face was touching the computer. And like in a call centre, I don't know if anybody remembers this call centre, 12 years ago, they were grim. The desk would be dirty from the people who sat down before you. I remember one day there was a computer and there was sick underneath it. And I obviously couldn't tell because I couldn't see the desk. Like, it was wood and the pattern, and I had touched it. Even now, I'm like tired to even think about it. Like, it was grim. And I told my manager I was struggling, didn't care. Did not care. Oh, get on with it. So we have targets to meet. I remember telling one manager in one call centre, and he was lovely about it. He was just like, we're not going to be able to promote you, though. You're not going to go further in this job. And to be honest with you, if we change our systems, you're not going to be able to do it. What are you going to do? So stayed in call centres for about 4 or 5 years, and I was suffering really badly with back pain, because no matter how big the monitor they try to give me, and only some of them actually did give me a bigger monitor, I still sit so close to my computer. It's the glare in what I try to do. I will always lean forward. It's just to see. So I didn't want to use screen readers. I didn't want to use adjustments because I didn't even know what an adjustment was. Nobody had told me I could get adjustments. Nobody had told me what we could do. So I just struggled on and left call centre after call centre. The doctor told me I should stop working because it's just not good for my back. And I was like, okay, so I shouldn't work in an office. What do you want me to do? He says, I just stop working. He says, go on benefits. And I was like, no, I'm not doing that. Didn't do that there. I went off and sick a few times, moved back home. My employment was colourful, and I didn't know my rights. I didn't know that I was entitled to adjustments. I didn't know that I was being discriminated against. And there was an instance with one of my employers who I was having back problems with the call centre. And again, quite a big employer. I was having problems with my back. I was waiting for adjustments. I told these and said bad eyesight. And I actually told them I was registered blind, and waiting for the adjustments took 4 or 5 months. By the time I got my adjustments, they weren't right because the systems had been updated. So I needed new adjustments. And it was an absolute nightmare. And I can remember a manager saying to me, you smoke, that's why your back's. I was just like, that's nothing to do with my back. I have a bad back because I don't have a chair that supports me. I have a tiny monitor. It's not an adjustable arm. Like, I'm struggling to do my job. Oh, no, you're just being dramatic about the whole thing. And I actually ended up walking out of the room crying. And I can remember coming back in. I got disciplined because I was upset, because apparently I was aggressive with being upset. And I was just like, what do you mean I walked out of the room crying? But I was aggressive, apparently, because a man crying is aggressive. And then same thing kind of happened in other places, all call centers, and it was just nobody cared. Do you know what I mean? Nobody really stopped to say, how can we support you, or we can get adjustments. But when I was working for this employer, they basically left me no choice but to contact the Equality Commission. So I contacted them. They told me my rights on a phone call, and I was like, oh my God, I've been discriminated against my whole life, and I didn't know this. Why did nobody tell me? This is teaching me as a young person with disability. Why is there no information about this? Why are we not supporting people leaving education with disability? Like, why did I have to find this out myself at 25, 26? And then I got a new job, which was we're quite a big employer within the UK. It was really going to be a really great job because we were actually asking for people with disabilities to apply. And I applied through this agency, and the agency assured me, yeah, I told them I was registered blind. I actually cried to the girl when I was at the interview because I just been so frustrated. I was at the end of my tether. I didn't think I was going anywhere. And I told the girl how I was registered blind and I just wanted a job. I just wanted to be able to buy a house or save and buy nice things because I'd never been able to do that. And she was like, we'll support you, no problem. Getting the job, training was great. The training was really good. They gave me all my handouts. Like I said, it was great. They didn't give me enlarged handouts, so I couldn't read them. But thankfully, I can make notes beside them, so I couldn't report. I could read it to me later. But in that job, it was good for the first 3 weeks of training, 4 weeks of training. And then when I got out on the floor, I had no adjustments. And then there was a fight between the agency and the place, the employer, who should be paying for my adjustments. So this went on for weeks. And I was off. I was taking like 24 tablets a day. I was taking anti-inflammatories. I was taking painkillers. I was taking I can't remember what the tablet was for my depression at the time. Like, I was on all these different tablets and having to take like handfuls of them at a time, and had to go off and leave. And there was rumors going around. One of the managers started a rumor saying it was really dramatic because he's disabled, and if you don't give him what he needs, he'll take you to court. And I was just like, where did this come from? So there were these rumors going around about me, and I was going to quit. And my partner kind of said, you can't do that. You can't put yourself through this. You can't keep running away when things like this happen. So stay in the job. Things were inclusive, they were accessible. And I just got on with it for about 2 years. And because they gave me a bigger monitor, and I was like, I've got a bigger monitor. I've got a headset. I can do my job. I can take calls, and that's it. And the systems, thankfully, were easy enough. I could just zoom in on them. But then my manager left, and things changed when she left. There was a lot of managements who didn't understand my disability. They would make comments about it. They would call me the blind boy. They would ask me why I was helping other people, because why would you help? You can't see. I was overlooked because apparently a disabled person can't work as well as a non-disabled person. And when I used to tell people I couldn't see a presentation or something, they would be like, can you see from here? And I'd take a seat and physically put it in front of the room, be like, can you see from here? Can you see from here? Can you see from here? And like, I'm not a child. If I told you I can't see, no matter where you're sitting in that room from a tiny screen, take me at my word. So I ended up leaving because it just became too much. And that's when I came into my current role. Again, I took you on a tangent there, telling my whole life story here.
I'm going to go back to one of the things you said right at the beginning of that. Your first two kind of call center roles, you said that they seemed really excited because they haven't got anyone with a disability working there. Do you think that influenced their hiring decision?
Oh yeah, like when it comes to see, D&I, to me is only something I've heard. Like, the DEI is diversity, equity, inclusion. It's the latest buzz within businesses the past couple of years, and it's only really kicked into gear since George Floyd. So it's only really kicked into gear since then, where businesses are really having to pay more attention to it and actually talk about it. Whereas before businesses, they talked about diversity. Diversity was the big word. You know, we want diversity of staff. We want equality. And we now know now you can't have equality without equity.
Yeah.
And that's only something that's come around with D&I the past few years. But see, before that, there are like companies, having somebody who's disabled was like a tick box. And I used to call myself the diversity hire because I could say I was gay and I could say I was disabled. And companies got excited about that there. And I think it was kind of like a buzz to them. Oh, this is something shiny and new. And oh my goodness, we can live this up to our HR teams. But there's a difference between hiring disabled people with disabilities. There's a difference in hiring us and actually retaining us. Because if you're bringing us in through into a job and you haven't got adjustment process, you aren't making us aware of what adjustments we can have. You're not making us aware that we're actually entitled to these adjustments and you should be providing them. If you haven't got people representation across your business with disability, back then there was none of that. It was very much that you were this little token for them to show off to HR, to show off to hire managers, but visiting managers. And like, I can remember a manager, been introduced to manager, like, this is Jamie, and he's blind, so he is. And I think they looked at me as if to say, well, he can't be blind. He's looking at me, like, straight back at me. Do you know what I mean? So I think it was very tokenistic. And then there was times I was just absolutely refused a job because, oh, you don't drive. And I can't explain to you. And disabled, I can't actually drive. I'm registered blind. Legally, I'd be on the curb and there'd be deaths and it wouldn't be good for anybody. But it was just tokenistic, so it is back then. And it was rare to find an employer who wanted to use your token. But when it did happen, it was almost as bad as being discriminated against. So it was, because it's almost like your pity or your their object to kind of make them look good to a hiring manager when really they're not really supporting you.
Yeah, I've managed in call centres, and that wasn't as far back as when you was working in them. But I was working in offices which had a pretty much a call centre setup with less staff. And going through interview process, training, supporting other managers with training and their hiring process as well.
Yeah.
I know that it's not a hard thing to be able to support someone with any disability or neurodiversity. And that's why I was interested in wondering what your take was on whether it was a token hire, or because how I heard it was, if they wanted to invest in you, and you know this now, they would have been asking you at that interview, what do we need to have at your desk on day one for you to do the job?
I guess it. I think that's what's missing even now. And I think the landscape for disability, for somebody who has a job seeker with disability, I think the landscape has changed drastically over the past few years. And I think working for AMS or working within recruitment, I've been able to see what really good looks like. And I've been able to experience what really bad looks like. And I think that gives me my kind of, I always say like my anger from the past, because I think sometimes when I talk about my past, it sounds like I'm angry about it. And I'm like, I am very angry about it, but the way that I channel that is in my work. And I think about the barriers that I face. And I'm like, well, how do we fix that for somebody else? And then when I speak to somebody else and hear their barriers, I'm like, how do we fix that for you? And I think that's what it's done, is now that I've got this empowerment, and I say empowerment because I found my voice for my disability at AMS. Like before, I would never have said I'm disabled. I would never have said I have a disability. I hated being called special. I hated all that. I still don't like being called special, but I have a disability, but I'm disabled by society. It was my previous employers who disabled me. I have a whole additional skill set. If I'm in a shop and I can't see something, I'll use my phone to zoom in. If I'm in the house and I can't see subtitles on the TV, I'll zoom in. And trust me, I've watched Lord of the Rings and I've had to zoom in for some, not Lord of the Rings, Game of Thrones. That's terrible, I mix them up. But I've had to be zooming in. And that's something that my partner now does when he's out in a bar, he now zooms in. And even my computer, there's ways that I do things, or ways that I make trackers are really a lot more accessible for me. And people want to use it as well. I'm just like, we have all this additional skills that when we stop and think about, okay, if we have to plan to go somewhere, we plan like it's a military operation. So we do, it's just, you're a wheelchair user, you have to make sure there's access. You have to make sure that you're going to be able to get on a train if you're getting a train. You have to make sure all these things are accessible. If I'm going somewhere, I have to ring up and make sure there's like somebody there to support me. You know, I've been put in the wrong bus and wrong train so many times by the people working there, but you know, we really have to plan like a military operation. Those are skills. We have all those skills. And as well as that, we have one of the biggest skills I think out there of anybody in the world, and that is we have perseverance. We struggle daily with accessibility, with lack of understanding. Employers talk when it comes to inclusion, but we persevere through it. we will stay in that job because it's better to have a job than not have one. It's better to be trying to work than having to live on a benefit, because we know benefits don't pay enough. There's a living crisis coming up with benefits, absolutely shocking. And the opportunities for people with disability, it's always much, very much, yes, we want to hire disabled people, but we aren't doing anything to retain them. There's disabled pay gaps, there is lack of representation. And I think for me, what employers need to do is they need to look at that additional skill set that we bring. They need to look at all those additional skills. Somebody using a screen reader, that's amazing, because that person can go and proofread that for you. That screen reader doesn't just benefit that one person on the team, it can benefit anybody else, or somebody who's neurodivergent. There's a whole different set of skills I think that we miss out on, and that's something I've been able to advocate in my work. And it's something I see that even the Valuable 500 are doing, Business Disability Forum, all those big names in disability all advocate for it. Jane Hatton from Evenbreak, she was the one who kind of talked to me about this here, and it actually led me to think, I'm disabled by society. We're disabled by society, and we need to change that. We need to start making and training people how to be more accessible, how to be more inclusive, and training employers, not even training, teaching employers that they need people with lived experience leading these training sessions on disability or neurodiversity. Because years ago, it was a person with non-disability standing telling me as a disabled person how to treat me. And it's just like, why is that narrative? That narrative is still here. We still have people who don't understand that lived experience. But don't get me wrong, there's amazing advocates and allies doing a really great job. But if you are coming from the right place, and a lot of businesses get this wrong so much, they don't come from the right place. They come from as a business process. Oh, this is a process. We have to think of a cost. We have to think of A, B, C, D. But you forget that's a person at the other end who's probably applied for twice as many jobs, if not more, than everybody else applying. And it's probably more knockbacks in that day than anybody's had in the whole year. So for me, I'm like, we have to look at additional skills and recognize there's so much more talent with those with disability that we just don't recognize.
Yeah, definitely. So looking at how when we first met, I didn't meet you thinking you was a chubby unicorn. I didn't meet you thinking you was another animal either, but it was another animal that kind of was when we started speaking a lot more, because I saw a lot of your posts about camels.
Well, yes.
In fact, camel case. So what is camel casing?
So camel case is when you use a capital letter for each new word in a hashtag. So if you are doing like hashtag do it, you'll do D as a capital and then I as a capital, so do it. And it's called camel case because it's almost like humps on the camel's back, the capital and then the gap, then the capital and then the gap. And what that essentially does is it supports people using screen readers. A screen reader, if it's a long hashtag, will mix up that word. It will start shooting at random letters. It'll get completely confused, and it's not a great user experience. And it's not only blind people or visually impaired people who use screen readers. People with cognitive disabilities use it, people who are neurodivergent, a whole range of people. As well as that, camel case just annoys the screen readers, but it's also really terrible to look at for somebody with visual impairment. So I have some site. I don't want to go through LinkedIn using my screen reader. Having to tab through LinkedIn is not enjoyable. I don't know if anyone else has ever done it. It's not enjoyable. So I want to be able to use my phone, or I want to be able to use my computer. Probably not very successfully, but I want to be able to do it. And when I come across hashtags and there's loads of them, or if I want to find something through a hashtag, I can't find it because it's not accessible. I don't know what that's saying. So you almost play on Scrabble in your head to try to work out what this says. And then if you think of somebody with dyslexia, look at that happening on Scrabble, all these random letters. And I posted about it today. I post about it every Wednesday. I'm about a week away, well, actually it was about 2 weeks away ago from finding a real camel. I want to find a real camel because I'm really trying to drive this home. And in the past 2 weeks, I've really seen momentum where people are starting to make the capitals in the hashtags because it just supports so many more people. And when you think about it as well, when you use a hashtag, it's open to interpretation. And I posted about this today. Susan Boyle, who Britain Got Talent singer, absolutely loves Susan, so I do love her. But her marketing team did this hashtag, which was said Susan's album party. Now, I'm not going to tell you what that said. If you've seen that written down on paper, or go look at my LinkedIn post, you'll see it. It's open to interpretation, and it was interpreted as a bum party, essentially. And it wasn't good, so it wasn't for her. So what they ended up having to do is they had to kind of apologize and then redo it. But that's open to interpretation. So not only is it better, clearer, and more visually pleasing to every user, but it supports those with a diverse range of disabilities. And it's only one of many tips that you can use online. And it's where the biggest gap is, I think, in disability at the moment is marketing teams don't use them. They don't use alt text, which is text that describes an image. They don't use closed captions, which is text which translates all spoken words, sound, narration to a video. They don't offer, they call it contrast pictures. The contrast of the writing on top of them isn't great. The poster is designed with terrible clashing colours. You can't read it. There's quite a few advocates at the moment who actually use pastel colours on top of pastel colours, which is completely unaccessible. So to me, I sit back sometimes, and this is prompted me to start posting about this stuff, is DEI, so the Diversity, Equity, Inclusion, that I is inclusion, right? People want A to be audited, so to be DEIA or change to ID or just move these letters around in your acronym. But to me, I'm like, do we need the A? I'll take it if it means people's going to be more accessible and think about accessibility. But inclusion to me is including everybody. It's being inclusive. And when your content or your marketing or your recruitment or whatever you're doing as a business or an individual is accessible, you're creating barriers. And when you think about how many barriers me or you have faced today alone, why do you want to add to that? Do you know what I mean? So by taking these simple steps, it will make a difference. And yes, it can be annoying if you have to go back and spell check a hashtag. I'm registered blind. If I'm having to go back and do it and use a keyboard to do it, there's no excuse why somebody with non-disability can't do it. So take those few extra moments, and really, it does really support everybody.
I'll tell you what really frustrates me about camel casing. And you're talking about society disabling as opposed to the disability disabling. And a lot of the social media programs, I don't know if it's all, but I know LinkedIn definitely does. You start typing your hashtag in camel case and it comes up on the drop down. You select it and it takes it out of camel case. And that's something that, to me, I then think, right, now I've got to go in and do something that I shouldn't have to. And I'm not doing for yourself or other people with visual impairment. I'm doing it because it's the right thing to do. But LinkedIn's making me do it.
Same as every platform does it. It reverts it always back. The only platform that actually does give you choice is Twitter. And if enough people on Twitter have used the camel case hashtag, it does come up in the options. It's not very many, to be fair, but there's some there. Forms like LinkedIn and Facebook and social media, any kind of social media platform there, really, they all do the same thing businesses do. They sometimes talk this talk about inclusion and, oh, we're the most accessible platform. And to me, the most accessible platform at the moment is Twitter. When you post a photo, it'll tell you you need to add alt text. And they did that because only 0.06% of images on there had alt text. So those people using screen readers had no clue what's going on. And like, when you think about it, that's a massive group of customers. You're missing out money, candidates, clients, friends, followers, whatever you're doing online, you're missing out. To me, I'm like, it's so easy to do. It's something that I would love to see taught in school. We get taught computer lessons in school, like ICT or word processing was the one I hated most. We have to learn touch type. When you think about those classes, why aren't we teaching how to do that online? Kids, when they come to do their GCSEs, are all on Facebook or something anyway. Why aren't we teaching a class in there and how to be more inclusive? Why are we not looking at how do we teach the next generation to be more accessible? Because when you ask any adult now why they don't do it, it's because it's unintentional. They aren't aware. And unless you make people aware, they're not going to change. And that's why I always try to hashtag be the change. I can't remember what the statistic is. It's 1 in 15 people, I think, is dyslexic. When you think about people with dyslexia as well, you think about people with cognitive disabilities, the number of people who you're impacting with inaccessibility. And if you just one person changes it, it has the same meaning. You're helping so many other people. And when you look at the big people on LinkedIn or on social media, the influencers, the content creators, they're the ones who need to be driving this, because they're the ones that people see doing it will change. And one person I'll say I approached about it was Leah Turner on LinkedIn. And if anyone's on LinkedIn doesn't know Leah Turner, where have you been? She's the queen of LinkedIn. She's incredible. She talked about your brand on LinkedIn, and I messaged her. It's like, hey, look, I love your content, because I really do. Like, when she posts, I get all excited. Like, I sit down in the mornings with my morning smoke, loving it. But I said to her, can you change your hashtags? Because when I get down to your post, I don't know what you're doing. Hashtags aren't just there to reinforce your post. People use that on Instagram to find things, on LinkedIn to find things, or on Twitter to find things. If they don't know what that says, they're not going to know what they're going looking for. And Leah changed it, so she did. And to this day, she has stuck that. Whereas I've messaged other people with quite big followings, and they haven't did anything. I was asked recently by somebody who is a content creator, business salesperson, and they were looking at me to come on about accessibility. And I love the person, the content's great, but they've told me so many times they're going to be accessible, and I've asked them, and they don't do it. So I'm like, I'm not going to come on your show and talk about what I do in accessibility and inclusion because you're not listening and you're not going to have this thing about profiting from disabled people sometimes. And I'm like, just because you see somebody who is doing well at the moment, you think you're going to change your whole appearance, your whole attitude about this. Okay, but you're not going to make a difference because I've asked you it so many times. Do you know what I mean? It's, don't be tokenistic when it comes to it. Either do it or don't, and then don't try to promote off it. So I know it sounds really harsh, but and I'm sorry if that person hears, but it's to me, I said no, because there was going to be no captions on the video. And I'm like, how can you ask me to come talk about accessibility and not be accessible? That's tokenistic.
Yeah.
And I think this is, do you know when you were wee and you were told every day is a learning day or every day is a school day and you used to roll your eyes and be like, oh my God, stop, but every day is not. As an adult, you learn every day actually is a school day because you're constantly learning. You're constantly having to learn, especially when you're working with a disability. I tell everybody, like when somebody says to me, I don't know how to pronounce or I don't know how to say this or I don't know, should I use the word disabled, disability? And I'm like, it's a minefield. There is so much uniqueness and authenticity to people. People will prefer one thing one day and next year not like it. When you think about people's identity, how they choose to express a disability, like I didn't express it always I was disabled. Now I can say it'll be fine. Somebody might hear this and be like, why is he calling me disabled? Is this my identity? I don't know if I'm forcing somebody else. And this is why I advocate for people first language. But we all learn. Language evolves. People evolve. We evolve. And I think that once you learn, we have to then start education because that's how you keep the message going. We have to keep communicating. But calling out for all attacks in that lesson is people don't know. Some people call it ID, image description. And like, to me, image description and alt text do some things. Image description tells you what an image is. People say ID and this is what the image is. Alt text describes in detail what it is. So there's all these different variations of it. But for me, I'm like, that whatever you call it, as long as it's there, it needs to be there because otherwise you're just putting up a picture for your Google website.
Yeah, because I put quite a bit of my alt text just to make it really stand out at the bottom of posts on LinkedIn because then it's showing other people that it's there.
Yeah.
So we're going to start to wrap up. If you could make one change to society, what would it be?
Easy. I would stop segregating young people when they're disabled. Why do you ship us off to special classes or special schools? When you go to work, you don't be put in a special work class. You don't be put in segregated. If you did that to an adult, you would be that would be discrimination. Why do we discriminate young people by putting them into special needs classes and special education? Yes, I appreciate we may sometimes need special support, but there's a difference in being segregated for that. I lost a lot of my confidence because of special education, not just because I left it, but also because I was so wrapped up in cotton wool. I was so unprepared for the real world. And we don't prepare young disabled people to come into the world. There's such a gap out there to support young people. And for me, my change would be to stop segregating because we teach children or young people in secondary school careers classes. We teach them how to go into the world to be, do you know what I mean? We prepare them a little bit better than we prepare children with disability, I feel. Things may have changed, but from people I speak to, it hasn't really much changed because kids are still being segregated. We need to stop segregating. We need to teach young people about accessibility in school. We need to teach them how to be better allies. We need to stop having a one-off workshop a year around being LGBTQ plus or being neurodiverse or being disabled. We need to stop one-off events and make it a permanent thing and measure it. How do you measure that? And that's why I'm actually really excited for the potential, well, my podcast that I've launched, as I said, Inclusivity. I have a sponsor who actually works within education, and that's one of my driving forces for it is there's such a gap. If I have to go through every school in the US, then the UK, then the EMEA, then APAC, across the world to take a program, I will do it. I will bring everybody on for the journey. But I think that we need to start educating young people to be more inclusive.
Yeah, and if we end that segregation, you look at the ripple effects. I love ripple effects. So number one, you're teaching the other people in the class about someone with a disability, and instantly then they're starting to learn, if it's myself, what types my access into a room. If it's yourself, they're looking about accessibility, and you're then looking at that potential mental health gap when you're starting to get flooded in, and it's there's just so many benefits to it.
And one of the things that like we all hear, I think we all hear oh, it's the right thing to do. Do you know what I mean? Oh, to be inclusive is the right thing. And I always think, yes, it is the right thing to do, but it's also value in it. There is value in learning difference. Two people with the same disability will never have the same experience. Two people with the same condition or similar conditions will never have the same experience. Everybody is so unique to their own lived experience. Whether you're disabled or not, we know disability impacts up to 15% of the population. Maybe that was the percentage I think of earlier. Disability affects 15% of the world's population. We're 1.2 billion, I think it is at the moment. And as the numbers just grow on, if you look at COVID, long COVID, your disability, the number of people with disability is impacting, and 80% of us will be impacted in our lifetime. So for me, I'm like, yes, it's the right thing to do, but there's value in learning and educating, because at one point in your life, and through long disability or temporary disability or permanent disability, you're potentially going to be impacted to somebody. So why wouldn't we want to do this now? Why are you waiting until you're in that position? If I could go back now and teach myself that and be able to advocate sooner for accessibility, oh my goodness, I would have done it 1,000 times over.
So thank you, everybody, for tuning in and listening. We will be back in 2 weeks. Remember, the schedule has changed from weekly to fortnightly. And thank you very much for listening. And Jamie, thank you very much for coming along.
Thank you.
Thank you for listening to the All for Inclusion podcast. We'd love you to subscribe and to help other podcast listeners find us more easily. Please leave us a 5-star rating and a review. And of course, feel free to pass the pod by sharing it with your family and friends. Remember, the podcast is available every Wednesday, and keep an eye out for additional bonus episodes. See you next time on the All for Inclusion podcast.